Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we are now in our Spring Pledge Drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. Please show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button, or texting KBOO to 44321. Our goal for this pledge drive is $60,000, so help us get there by becoming a member today. In 1980, Oregonians passed a ballot measure prohibiting the siting of any new nuclear power plants until there is an operating federal repository for high-level nuclear waste. The law also requires a vote before any future nuclear facility is approved. 40 years later, still no federal waste repository exists, nor is there a chance of one being created in the foreseeable future. But now, there are companion bills in the Oregon State Senate and House that would create exemptions from both the nuclear waste and public vote provisions of the 1980 measure that would allow the construction of small nuclear reactors in Oregon. Today we talk with Damon Mott-Story, Healthy Climate Program Director with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about why so-called small modular nuclear reactors are just as dangerous and irresponsible as the larger reactors that Oregon law banned in 1980. Damon, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, it's amazing to me that here we are today talking about nuclear power, and it's something that 40 years ago I thought we were done with. And so I want to start by talking about the brief or not so brief history of the demise of nuclear power in Oregon and why it's so out of character with the direction the state's been going in for the last 40 years that we're faced again with this rising interest in what's now called small modular nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that's a good place to start. So I think it's good to zoom out and remember some of the history of nuclear power in Oregon. There was a really amazing group of concerned Oregonians who in 1980 managed to pass a statewide ballot measure called Measure 7. Now, what this measure did was it put some very common sense protections and restrictions into place for nuclear power reactors in the state of Oregon, saying that if a company wanted to try to site a new nuclear power plant within our state borders, they would first need to get statewide voter approval to do so, and also there would need to be a viable permanent geological repository for nuclear waste established by the U.S. federal government. Now, that's something that we've not ever had. Ever since the dawn of the nuclear age, the U.S. government has been promising that they will eventually find a spot to put this very, very radioactive waste that is created as a byproduct, as a waste product from the manufacturing of nuclear weapons and the production of nuclear power. Some of which is so toxic, so dangerous that it would kill you if you stood next to it without any protection and without any barriers, within seconds. And some of which is still toxic for over tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of years. It can be the length of the half-life of some of these very radioactive contaminants. And we actually have a fair bit of that radioactive waste in Oregon along the Columbia River at the site of the now decommissioned Trojan nuclear plant at Rainier. So if you go over the bridge from Longview, Washington, on your way to Astoria from Portland or something like that, you'll be driving by where there used to be a nuclear power plant. And the waste is still being stored in dry casks where that power plant used to be. So, you know, it was a very common sense, a very, very wise decision that Oregon voters made in 1980, and that's been the law of the land for the 41 years since. And as you said, in recent years, starting in 2017, every long legislative session that we've seen in Oregon, there have been bills proposed to exempt smaller nuclear reactors from this 1980 law. And what I mean by that is there are a number of different design firms, one of which is based in Oregon called NuScale Power, and they are trying to license and construct so-called small modular nuclear reactors, which are individually a lot smaller than a conventionally sized nuclear power plant, but which would be built in packs of up to 12 in order to generate a fair amount of electricity in aggregate. But it's important to remember that no such reactor of this type actually exists in a commercial capacity yet. They haven't made their way all the way through the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's licensing process. But even so, NuScale is working with largely Republican legislators to try to get an exemption from Oregon's laws. That's what they've been trying to do for the past few years in the state legislature.
Well, I want to zoom out a little bit more and go upstream on the Columbia River a couple hundred miles, where to me is this is the greatest lesson of why you don't build any more nuclear reactors. And that's the Hanford Reservation, which has an immense amount of radioactive contaminated waste and also chemical waste all over the place. Much of it is dripping down into the aquifer. It's gone into the Columbia River. It's a very scary place. And after, I think they've been trying to clean it up now for probably just about 40 years as well. And they have done some cleanup, but there's still an immense amount left. What do you feel are the lessons from Hanford that we should be looking at when we start talking about building any kind of nuclear reactor in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really think that everyone who lives in the Pacific Northwest should pay a pilgrimage to Hanford at some point to just better understand the history of this region and how it played into the U.S.'s military plans during World War II, during the nuclear arms race. So the Hanford site in eastern Washington, which is about a four-hour drive up the river from Portland and Vancouver, is a really large site that was up one of the three different main sites of the Manhattan Project in the 1940s. And this is where they manufactured the plutonium that was eventually put into the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. In addition to that, the Hanford site kept going long after World War II in manufacturing plutonium for additional nuclear weapons that were stockpiled in the United States or tested in various places. And there is just an unbelievable amount of very, very radioactive waste that is still there. They put it into underground tanks, and those underground tanks have corroded, and there's a big problem with getting some of the most concentrated waste out of the bottoms of those tanks and into a more stable storage location. Right now, there's a large plume of contaminants that are making their way through the soil and approaching the Columbia River aquifer. At one point, the Columbia River was one of the most radioactive bodies of water in the world. There's been a lot of better cleanup approaches since then, but it's still a major concern. And this was really the form of sort of what we see around the world is of basically a kind of nuclear colonialism, right? And there were people who were living in eastern Washington who were displaced, some of whom were native peoples and some of whom were white settlers who were farmers, who were displaced to make room for this large nuclear research facility where the workers were not told what they were doing. They said it was a top secret mission to end the war, but they weren't being told what they were manufacturing, and they didn't know what the dangers were of working with these materials. And then, you know, that's just connected to the ways that nuclear colonialism have happened in other parts of the world as well, from uranium mining on the Navajo Nation and the Spokane Nation, where a lot of uranium mines still have not been covered up or cleaned up or managed in any way, even though they're very close to where people have homes and who are living and working and playing. And it also is connected to some of the nuclear testing that happened in Nevada, which spread radioactivity over long, long distances, and in the Marshall Islands, where many people have been displaced because of radioactive contamination that has led to birth defects and all sorts of different health impacts. And so, you know, Hanford is just one piece of a global legacy of very toxic nuclear contamination and disruption to people's way of life. And it's basically a very large unsolved problem. There's still a lot of waste there, even though nuclear weapons manufacturing isn't happening at Hanford anymore. There's just a lot of unsolved problems and a lot of situations where they're not entirely sure what all is buried in different parts of the site. So Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility does, we lead groups of people to do tours of the Hanford site. We sign people up for the U.S. Department of Energy's Hanford tours and then lead discussion groups to sort of, you know, help people process what they're seeing out there. And kind of help people react to it in various ways. So we're hopeful that at some point when we are able to go back to doing more in-person things, that we can start up those tours again. But yeah, Hanford is a is a really important piece of the Northwest history, and it's something I think we all need to reckon with. And it's important to know that even though there's not nuclear weapons manufacturing happening at Hanford, there is a small amount of land being leased to Energy Northwest for the use of the Columbia Generating Station, which is the Pacific Northwest's currently only operating commercial nuclear power plant, and it services publicly owned utilities in Oregon and Washington. So we hear a lot about how a lot of us are getting electricity from the hydroelectric dams. Well, actually, those same utilities are also getting about 10% of their power from nuclear power generated next to the Hanford site.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what that nuclear power plant used to be called. As I understand, it was called, whoops, back when I was doing my work on Hanford 40 years ago. And there was this big scandal going on with the Washington Public Power Supply System, whoops, which was going to build five reactors. And there were two that were actually built, as I understand, at Hanford. One is mothballed, and the other one is the only operating facility. And then there's three more that were mothballed
in different parts of Washington.
One of the main ones is right near the Olympic Peninsula.
Grays Harbor.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the lessons that we learned from whoops in terms of just the financing of nuclear power and what a boondoggle that can be.
Yeah, that's right. So it's, the Washington Public Power Supply System, WPPSS, or whoops for short, is a really appropriate moniker for what happened because basically there was a big event, a big promotion around different public utilities saying that this was going to be so cheap, that it would be too cheap to meter. This nuclear power was going to be so economical and such a public good for everybody who invested in it. And it did not turn out that way. It was massively over budget and ended up becoming the largest municipal bond default in American history. And so, as you said, four out of the five of the plants are currently not happening. Most of them flopped. And actually, Pacific Northwest ratepayers in public utility districts like the Eugene Water and Electric Board and Clark County PUD are still paying off the debt of the Washington Public Power Supply System, or whoops, accident. And so recognizing that there was sort of a major public relations disaster on their hands, they rebranded themselves and they're now called Energy Northwest, which sounds a lot more benign than whoops.
Well, you were talking about how people should be all making pilgrimages out to Hanford to understand what's going on there. One of the things that disturbs me is actually how little known Hanford is outside of the Pacific Northwest, and to some degree even here. A number of years ago, I was at a Society of Environmental Journalists conference at Stanford, and I was at this luncheon roundtable about nuclear power and whether nuclear power was a green alternative. And this woman who was leading the panel, who was the head of the Environmental Journalism Department at Stanford, said, well, all these people I've been talking to this week are really proponents of nuclear power and really think it's a very important way to deal with climate change. And I said to her, well, living in the Pacific Northwest, I have a very different feeling about nuclear power and its safety living just downstream from Hanford. So she said to me, what's Hanford? Is that the same as Three Mile Island?
Mm.
And what I didn't say to her, which I wish I had, is how can you be the head of the Environmental Journalism Department here at Stanford and not know what Hanford is? So why do you think it is that so few people, even in the upper echelons of academia, don't know what Hanford is?
You know, I don't think it's a mistake that especially, you know, the U.S. Department of Energy has not really wanted to have a high profile on Hanford because it's an enormous, enormous environmental catastrophe, basically. There's so much very toxic radioactive waste that we just don't have a good solution for dealing with. And because it has taken so long, you know, close to, you know, we're now at about the 80-year point from when the Hanford nuclear project started, that that there's a lot of things where we just don't really know even necessarily what all is buried out there. Like I said, Dirk Dunning is a retired engineer from the Oregon Department of Energy who spent a large part of his career on working to try to find better solutions for Hanford. And I've heard him speak very compellingly about, you know, we need to reckon with this a little bit more truthfully. But the fact of the matter is it's not something that anyone can really be all that proud of, right? It's like the fact that there is so much, you know, very dangerous waste out there that no one has a really good idea of how to protect ourselves from. means that there's not much pride in being able to talk about that. And I think it just is easier, especially the U.S. government, to sort of sweep that under the rug as much as they can and sort of draw people's attention to away to other things. And when you go and take a look at some of the museum style exhibits that are out there, the emphasis is placed very, very strongly on the myth that dropping the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended World War II, and that that there were many lives that were saved by the end of the war that was brought by those nuclear weapons. And it's always important to remember that that's a very contested claim. Basically, the war was ending, and most of the people who died in the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were civilians, Japanese civilians, women and children, and that the legacy of that contamination lasted for a long time and destroyed many people's lives and livelihoods. So there's not much to be proud of around Hanford, and I think that that's why not many people know about it. But I think it's important for all of us to know about it, especially in the energy world, especially in the climate world, because we need to be able to take the lessons around understanding that, yes, we need to decarbonize, we need to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from our electricity sector. But in doing so, it's very important that we don't cause another existential crisis. That's why Physicians for Social Responsibility is so committed to making sure that we understand the connections between the existential crisis of nuclear technology and the existential crisis of climate change.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Story, Healthy Climate Program Director with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the dangers of small modular nuclear reactors, which have become the darling of people like Bill Gates and certain Republicans here in the state of Oregon. We're talking about the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'm also thinking about Fukushima, which was a self-inflicted wound on the part of the Japanese. I wonder how you look at the lessons of Fukushima in terms of understanding why we have to be so careful when people start promoting nuclear power as an alternative to fossil fuel.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up. In fact, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility just hosted a commemoration of the 10th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, which was last month. So that happened in March of 2011. It was far worse even than people realized at the time. So 150,000 people were evacuated when the tsunami breached the nuclear power reactors at Fukushima Daiichi. And then it basically over time, we have now learned and realized that there are about 1.5 million people who live in parts of the Fukushima prefecture who are downwind from ongoing radiation exposure from the reactors at levels that are unsafe for women and children, especially. There's a number of different issues that play here. One of the things that the Japanese government did pretty immediately after the disaster happened was start to move the goalposts and change the government standards around what was considered a healthy or safe amount of radioactivity exposure. In order to claim that there was no risk to the public from the Fukushima contamination. But then second, what also is an issue is that in the field of public health and in the field of radiation exposure, it's super important for us to be advocating for a more feminist lens on this kind of research because at this point, most radiation exposure research is based upon something called reference man. And it's literally what it sounds like. It's about how it is that sort of a 180-pound typical, 6-foot white male would be impacted by a certain dosage of radioactivity. But it doesn't take into account how women's bodies and children's bodies, who are much smaller, right, and don't have as much body mass. And we know also from the field of looking at air pollution that diesel for particulate matter impacts children more than adults because their lungs are just much smaller and the same exposure can be as harmful. The same is true for radioactivity as well. This is a huge problem because all of this amounts to a lot of kind of junk science that can be pointed to say that life in Fukushima 10 years later is perfectly safe when there's a lot of reason to believe that it is not. And so I was very grateful to some of our members, including Yukio Kawano, a third-generation hibakusha, the granddaughter of a survivor of the Hiroshima bombing, was one of the organizers who put together this a film screening of a film called Little Voices from Fukushima, which is well worth a watch to understand what is the real impact on especially mothers and their children in Fukushima after the disaster happened there. And it's worth also pointing out that in the sort of post-mortem of what happened at Fukushima, it was revealed after the fact, and the company finally admitted that there were a number of earthquake sensors that needed to be replaced that had not been replaced. And so, had the maintenance at the reactors in Fukushima had been a little bit more scrupulously done, it's possible that the disaster could have been averted and safety mechanisms could have been put in place before the tsunami compromised the reactor cores. That's one of the major lessons to be learned from Fukushima is that companies around the world and governments around the world who have been in charge of overseeing nuclear reactors have always promised that the chances of disaster are infinitesimally small, and that the risk to the people living nearby them is very, very low. And they point to various, data and studies of all these people who have lived next to reactors for a long, long time and never had any issues, blah, blah, blah. While what we know is true is that there are higher rates of thyroid cancer near some reactor communities, and that when disasters do happen, they're always unforeseen circumstances or deferred maintenance and things like that that were not disclosed to the public. In fact, we saw testimony on one of the bills in the Oregon legislature this year from retired engineer Dirk Dunning, who said that there are a number of stopgap fixes that are currently in place at the Columbia Generating Station in eastern Washington on the Columbia River that he's very concerned about, right? And those are exactly the kinds of sort of not so prominently mentioned issues at nuclear power reactors that could lead to a really major disaster at some point if there's a major earthquake or other natural disaster or something like that.
Well, I want to circle back to Hanford again, just maybe one last time. But 2 points. One is that I'm not sure if I'm right about this, but I remember hearing after Fukushima that the design of the Fukushima reactors and the reactor at Hanford are very similar. And I just want to talk about some of the dangers of that design. Now, of course, the proponents of small modular nuclear reactors will poo-poo this because they'll say they've solved all these problems.
Yeah, I think just like the real quick nuts and bolts of it is that nuclear power is the process of breaking apart, mostly uranium atoms that then leads to a chain reaction of breaking apart other uranium atoms and making them unstable, and that's what's called nuclear fission, and it generates a whole lot of heat when you get that chain reaction going. And then that heat within usually some sort of a large cube-like container in these reactors creates a whole lot of energy that then boils water, right? And then the steam from that water turns a turbine and generates electricity. So Indian environmental Vandana Shiva calls nuclear power the most expensive way to boil water. The most expensive and complicated way of boiling water. And that's essentially what both the Fukushima and Columbia Generating Station nuclear power reactors are designed around. They're both light water boiling water reactors. And they're about approximately the same size and very, very similar in design and very subject to a lot of the same vulnerabilities and weaknesses. Our reactor was built in the 1980s and was relicensed to operate until the 2040s, but it's already approaching the average lifespan of a nuclear power reactor of that type, which is about 39 years old. The fact that utilities in the Pacific Northwest are still banking on this reactor hanging around for another 20, 25 years is really pretty magical thinking, and I think it's much wiser to look at how we can safely decommission this plant before more of the internal parts and mechanisms start to need replacement from the massive amount, again, of heat that is generated on these facilities, which leads to a breaking down of the small parts and equipment and machinery over time. And there's not a lot of transparency revealed to the public on exactly where all of those different deferred maintenances might be, because there's a lot of sort of top secret, you know, sort of information that is only for the company to know and for the regulators to know, and they consider it, you know, a breach of security to reveal a lot of the details of what's been going on in the inner workings of those reactors. But again, the lesson to be learned here is that with these so-called small modular nuclear reactors that companies like NuScale are promoting, and they're saying that they're much safer. They're saying that they don't rely on any water coolant in order to mitigate the potential of an overheating or meltdown type situation. Is that we have been promised time and time again that there are totally safe reactors that then go on to situations like what we saw in Chernobyl and Fukushima. And so just because there's a small chance, a very, very small chance of a meltdown, doesn't mean there's no chance of a meltdown. And the consequences of if that happens are just catastrophic.
Well, let's talk a bit about the waste disposal issue at Hanford as well, since it was originally almost designated as the National Waste Repository for the nuclear waste that was generated all around the United States. And there were going to be these long caravans of trucks carrying this waste through cities. And it was a scenario that scared the daylights out of anybody who lived on one of those routes, including people in Portland, because they were going to go right up I-5. Let's talk about why that didn't happen and what that shows about how difficult it is to find a permanent waste repository for nuclear waste.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in exactly why Hanford wasn't ultimately selected as a permanent repository for the nation's nuclear waste, but you know, what we've basically found in almost all of the in every single one of the proposed repositories for this waste is that there's some major risk that is incurred with concentrating all of the waste from the Los Alamos site, from all of the different nuclear power reactors across the country, from other research facilities and things like that, that when you throw all of that into one place, you are dealing with a much larger volume of this very volatile material, and you are also dealing with you know, needing to think about the very, very, very long-term future of having all of this in one place, still hot for many, many, many hundreds of years to come. Yucca Mountain was also one of the proposed sites for a permanent repository. And it was found that in order to make the project viable, they would have had to install drip shields 100 years after burying the waste, because if they installed those drip shields in right immediately, they would have melted due to how hot all of the material was. But if they were to wait longer than 100 years to install these drip shields, that there would be a high chance of exposure from all of this material, from basically all of the water that from rainfall that comes soaks to the ground and would move over the waste repository, would then seep into the aquifer that supplies Las Vegas metropolitan area. I use that example as a way of showing like there's just a lot of complicated factors that come around finding a viable solution for what to do with safely storing this waste. The Hanford site's not good for it. The Yucca Mountain site is not good for it. At this point, we don't have a long-term single site that is viable. And in lieu of that, the U.S. Department of Energy is looking at a so-called consolidated interim storage site in New Mexico. The proposal there is to ship all of the nation's nuclear waste to that site temporarily until we can find a permanent site. But because of how successful that effort has been in the past 80 years, and by that I mean not successful at all, there's a lot of concern there. And particularly indigenous communities in the area are fighting back hard because they are already, you know, still dealing with the legacy of contamination from uranium mines. And now they might have to also deal with having a major consolidated collection of nuclear waste that could end up sitting there for a lot longer than what it would be proposed. But yes, the other point you brought up is that our roads and bridges and rail lines and things like that are all in need of some infrastructure fixes. And you know, we've seen the oil train derailment in Mosier in 2016 is a good example of the fact that we can't always depend upon all of our transit infrastructure to not spill, to not derail, and the consequences of a major, you know, breach of some of this radioactive waste being transported is such a major risk that we should basically not be moving this waste until we actually have a permanent site that we can feel good about sending stuff to.
Well, you mentioned you're not exactly sure why the Hanford site didn't work out as a permanent waste repository. My recollection is that the Yakima Nation had a lot to do with that, and particularly Russell Jim, and that if you notice, all these sites that they want to make into permanent waste repositories are indigenous sites. They're often, they're sacred land. And so I think that they've got a big fight ahead to get any of these sightings happen. And I'm also a little bit hopeful with our new Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, that she understands things in a different light than the previous Secretaries of Interior have. And you are listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. We're talking today with Damon Mott-Story, Healthy Climate Program Director with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about why the new push for what's being called small modular nuclear reactors is such a dangerous idea. One of the things that strikes me as being the most dangerous of all the things we're dealing with this new push for these small nuclear reactors, is that they've been embraced by part of the climate movement. So I wanted to talk about some of the key players who are have been proponents of nuclear power as an alternative to fossil fuel, what their arguments are, and what you would say to argue against those arguments.
Yeah, this is a really important and big problem. And like I said earlier in the interview, I think first and foremost, we need to make sure that we're not trading one existential crisis of climate chaos and climate change and all of the disasters that come with that for a different existential crisis, which is nuclear waste and its contamination and everything that comes along with that. But even that being said, nuclear power is really not one of the best alternatives to fossil fuel electricity, even if you just are looking at it from a perspective of carbon emissions, because the process of mining and transporting uranium to then be enriched into nuclear fuel, and then and the actual process of then putting that into the reactor and then dealing with the waste and sometimes having to transport the waste and then having to store the waste on site at nuclear reactors for who knows how long. All of that has a carbon footprint associated with it. There's an enormous amount of concrete, for example, that goes into building reactors and building the dry casks for storing nuclear waste. And so there's been a fair amount of work being done to sort of try to estimate what the average life cycle greenhouse gas emissions are from in generating a megawatt of electricity using nuclear power. And it's actually quite a lot larger than the footprints of manufacturing solar panels or wind turbines and things like that. And so in terms of, you know, the so-called carbon-free or emissions-free forms of generating electricity, nuclear power is actually one of the more carbon-intensive options out there. It's also one of the most expensive ways of generating electricity. Pretty much the only reason why we have nuclear power is because of enormous subsidies from the U.S. Department of Energy. Some listeners may remember Atoms for Peace, right? It was like a big push by the U.S. government to market nuclear technology as something that could be used not in wartime. It does not pencil out without major taxpayer-funded subsidies from the U.S. federal government. Now let's take a look at the NuScale small modular design company in Oregon, which was started at Oregon State University from a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. Over the lifetime of this company, they have received close to $1 billion in federal grants and subsidies and tax credits from the U.S. government, and have not produced a single commercial reactor to generate a single electron of power over all of that time. So the NuScale pilot project proposed in Idaho was originally supposed to become operational in 2016. Its current estimated start date is 2029 or 2030. In the past 5 years, the cost of that project has doubled from $3 billion to $6 billion. And so even if there were not a wide array of ethical issues with nuclear power and the sourcing of its fuel and the disposal of its waste, the major issue at hand is that it is not going to be a viable technology fast enough to deal with the climate crisis, because we know that we need to half, basically cut in half our carbon emissions over the next 9 years. We are really running out of time. And by 2030, global climate scientists are saying that we need to make those major carbon reductions. And if the only nuclear project on the books in that actually has any sort of initial green lights in the United States is not slated to start until 2029 at the latest. That's just not soon enough to be able to deal with all of the issues that that we are facing in terms of needing to decarbonize our electricity grid and source transportation with clean electricity, and so on and so forth. So what we're actually seeing and is a large-scale form of climate grift, is what I'm calling it, because the U.S. government is just pouring money into research and development for nuclear power reactors that are just not actually producing any electricity. They're not serving any load needs, and they're far more expensive than wind, solar, and battery technologies that are already viable, that are deployable now, and that don't have the same kinds of safety and health concerns. And so what we need to really urgently be doing is making sure that those dollars and those resources are not waylaid by an industry, the nuclear industry, that is not actually demonstrating any results from it, and which has all of these other ethical issues and concerns and problems. That's one of the major issues going on here, is that people that are looking for a technocratic fix, or who are positioning nuclear power as a important backstop to wind and solar, they claim that we need something for when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, but we can make it work with batteries, microgrids, demand response technology. We just don't need nuclear power as a part of the clean electricity future. It's not a clean energy source, and it has a large greenhouse gas footprint in the fuel and disposal of waste, and it is so expensive and so unviable in meeting the timelines that we need, that that I think it's an urgent issue for all climate activists to disavow.
I want to do a little mind reading now. What's going on inside the minds of people like James Hansen, who has been such a leader in awakening us to the dangers of impending climate chaos? Al Gore, who's another person who I think has come out saying that we need nuclear power in the interim, and a number of other prominent environmentalists. Why are they falling for nuclear power? What's their justification for you seeing nuclear power as a bridge fuel? And these are even people who are saying natural gas is not a bridge fuel, but nuclear power is.
Yeah, I think that there's a fair amount of magical thinking that comes into this, but I think there's also major dollar signs at play. It's really important to follow the money, right? Like the fact of the matter is, the U.S. Department of Energy has not only overseen nuclear regulation in the United States ever since the dawn of the nuclear age, but it has also been the largest promoter of nuclear power. And so that means that there's been, a long-term bipartisan support in Congress for major subsidies to nuclear power in order to basically cast a sort of a more beneficial light onto the nuclear industry than just a nuclear weapons manufacturer, right? And so that means that there is an enormous amount of money. Many of these, Bill Gates' reactor design companies and NuScale Power have received, tens of millions of dollars of grant money from the U.S. Department of Energy. And that money is specifically earmarked by Congress for nuclear design and research. So that is just currently not available for other technology sources. So I think that's one of the major issues at play here, is that there are grant monies available that we need to be very vocal in telling our congresspeople and senators that we do not support. And then there's also a little bit of a technocratic fantasy that comes along with this as well, that we'll be able to solve the climate crisis through technological innovation and not having to really change our behaviors or make, sort of larger infrastructure changes. So the way that we're really used to generating electricity is having these major big power plants, be they coal-fired or gas-fired, that are then very consolidated and then pipe, wire out the electricity to different cities and towns and communities. And nuclear power really fits within that infrastructure pretty well, right? You can kind of swap out a coal-fired power plant with a nuclear power plant that's generating a large amount of megawattage, or an array of smaller modular nuclear power plants that add up to a large amount of electricity. And it kind of works well to sort of just plug and play that and transition that from fossil fuels. So, and you know, there's also one of the talking points that people like to use is that the amount of land that solar panels take up compared to the amount of land that a nuclear power reactor takes up is a big difference. But I think that's a really, you know, silly comparison because that misses out on the fact that solar panels can be, you know, put on like sort of multifunctional space like rooftops. And also it misses the very obvious point that if a nuclear power plant melts down, that's a whole lot of land that becomes uninhabitable and unusable, basically turns it into a sacrifice zone. So I think those are some of the things that are going through the heads of some of these folks that are, you know, kind of searching for technocratic fixes to the climate crisis, and missing the opportunity that the climate crisis presents of not only changing the way we generate electricity, but also the mechanisms of how we generate electricity, the idea that we could be generating it locally and have community ownership over solar panel projects and battery backup as a way of creating disaster resilient communities that have community charging centers where people can make sure that they have electricity for their devices if the larger grid goes offline. In some cases, that's life-saving for people who have medical devices that need uninterrupted access to electricity. So the transition to clean energy really offers a lot of opportunities to rethink not just what kinds of technologies we use to generate power, but also how we do it and decentralizing things a little bit and returning control of our electricity generators to the people. And nuclear power just doesn't fit with that kind of a transition. But wind and solar do. So that's another thing we should be considering here.
Well, it was interesting. I saw Bill Gates on Stephen Colbert a couple of weeks ago, and he was promoting his new book, and Stephen Colbert brings up what appeared to be, to Colbert, to be a rather strange concept of bringing back nuclear power. And he gave Gates a kind of hard time about it, and Gates held his ground. I don't remember Colbert actually getting into the waste issue, but it seemed that he raised enough concerns that I wonder if he doesn't reflect kind of the common knowledge, if in fact there is a lot of resistance from the public right now to really wanting to go back to nuclear power.
Yeah, I mean, there's an enormous amount of resistance to nuclear power. So there were three bills that were proposed in the Oregon legislature this year that would have exempted small modular nuclear reactors from Oregon's Common Sense 1980 restrictions on the siting of new nuclear reactors. All of them were, you know, sort of on the books because NuScale Power, the small modular reactor design company here in Oregon, were trying to move them forward and working with legislators to try to push them forward. But when there was actually a public hearing for one of them, there was nobody signed up in support to testify in favor of the bills. And so what we're seeing here is that there's not some major shift in terms of public opinion on nuclear power. There are maybe some people that are willing to consider it because they're so worried about the climate crisis. But I think that the realities are that, you know, that it's just not a viable way to get to a decarbonized electricity grid, no matter how you slice it, and no matter how you feel about the technology itself. So, yeah, I think that it's true that there's still a lot of major public concerns around nuclear power that just don't exist for renewable technologies like wind and solar. And so we're going to see a lot of wealthy technocrats like Bill Gates going on talk shows and things like that. But the fact remains that we don't know how to generate nuclear tech power without creating this very toxic, long-lived radioactive waste. And even if you're doing it in smaller quantities, it doesn't matter. That waste is still highly, highly volatile and can cause a lot of problems. And so the branding and marketing may have gotten better for these new so-called advanced reactor design companies, but the cost overruns and delays are still there. And they all still produce waste that we don't know what to do with and don't have a place to dispose of.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. We're talking today with Damon Mott-Story, who's the Healthy Climate Program Director with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And we're talking about just what's wrong with the whole concept of small modular nuclear reactors that are being promoted by certain factors of the high-tech world and also in the Oregon State Legislature. For the last part of the show, I'd like to talk about how we've gotten back here. I want to go back again to 1980, when nuclear power was very unpopular. It was a year after Three Mile Island almost destroyed Western Pennsylvania. And people at that point, as far as I understand, most of the contracts for new nuclear power reactors just collapsed. And in fact, at a certain point, there were no more power reactors being planned. And then we started to see a resurgence, I don't know, maybe like 15, 20 years ago. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about this kind of circular thinking and how we've gotten back to the arguments that it seemed were so well positioned, both market arguments as well as safety arguments and scientific arguments that were, we thought, resolved in 1980.
Again, I think it's a great question, and I think that there's just a lot of money to be made here, right? Like the contractors and all of the people that would be involved in building some of these very large-scale projects, there's a lot of money to be made, and there's still a lot of money earmarked from the U.S. federal government for grants and subsidies for these kinds of technologies. And so I think that that's the reason why this is still this kind of whack-a-mole, keeps coming up again and again over time, sort of an issue. It's important to remember, by the way, that it wasn't just Three Mile Island in 1979, but also the Church Rock uranium mill spill in New Mexico on the Navajo Nation, which was actually one of the largest accidental releases of radioactivity in U.S. history, and is not talked about nearly as often as it should be because it happened largely to indigenous people. My friend Leona Morgan is a Diné Navajo activist, and she has a lot of really great presentation materials that everyone should go check out to understand exactly what all happened there and how many communities had their drinking water contaminated by the wastewater from uranium mining operations. But yeah, no, there has really been no successful nuclear projects that have been penciling out in the past 25 years or so. We've seen a string of bankruptcies and canceled projects and overruns on the time estimates for when projects are completed. And there's really no reason to believe that these Bill Gates concepts or new scale power concepts are going to fare any differently, in part because there is just a lot of, even though there are so many federal subsidies available for these technologies, there are just an enormous amount of costs that come with going through all of the hurdles of building one of these projects and licensing a new design and the process that goes into that. Brazenly, there are some nuclear proponents that are saying that the issue at hand is that there are too many safety regulations at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is a pretty appalling thing to say in the context of the very recent nuclear disasters that we've seen from Chernobyl and Fukushima, which were not ancient history. This was only 10 years ago that that happened in Japan. I think that there is just there's a contingent of people that are really hanging on to this as a possibility. And the fact that it's not actually creating any carbon emissions when you split the atom and boil water with the heat that comes off of it, that it makes it something where people are able to market it as part of the climate solution. And for all of the reasons that we've discussed, it just isn't going to be a viable way of doing that. And it's just not a ethically or morally responsible way of tackling the climate crisis. And it's not going to be able to happen in time. All of the barriers and issues that we've seen mean that we can't count on it to actually get us on the carbon reduction timeline that we need to see to address climate change.
Well, there also seems to be some kind of short-term and long-term memory loss. And that's what keeps boggling my mind, is I just keep going back to when that law was passed in Oregon in 1980, where there was such a strong reaction. And then it took, again, another 12 years before the Trojan nuclear power plant was shut down. But we look at all, and that's another good example of all the mendacity in the nuclear power industry and all the lies and cover-ups about the dangers of the Trojan plant and how that was finally revealed. It was, they never made a movie out of it like they did about Karen Silkwood, but it was very similar kinds of issues. And I think that that is, the nuclear power industry is riddled with that kind of corruption. I just wonder how they can keep getting away with it.
Yeah, I think they in part benefit off of, you know, when a new generation grows up and hasn't got the personal memory of things like Three Mile Island and the Church Rock uranium mill spill happening, like then it's just not as present and it's not as close for that new generation. You know, I'm a millennial. I'm in my late 20s, and I find that, you know, there's a lot of people that just don't personally remember some of these different things, and I think that that's part of it. That's why it's important that we're talking about it, and I'm so glad that you're having me on today. The good news is that none of those three bills in the Oregon legislature that were proposed exemptions for small modular nuclear reactors, none of those bills are moving forward. They all missed the deadline for getting a work session to be moved forward for a vote. So we aren't going to see any progress on those particular bills, but we need to speak up and speak out about this as often as we can, especially to state lawmakers and members of Congress and the U.S. Senate, and let them know that how we feel about this, and talk about it with our neighbors and friends. Encourage people to go visit Hanford and understand, you know, a part of the legacy of the history of the Pacific Northwest. Because it can be really easy to not pay attention to the history of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, because it's big, it's looming, it's scary, it's intense. It's also really important for us to learn from this history so that we don't continue to have the risk of repeating it as more people continue to kind of poke around and search for those large federal grants and the money that comes with that. You know, that's a real risk that we need to continue to bat back and understand that we need to not break this cycle. We need to continue forward with the proven, safe, clean, and viable renewable technologies at our disposal.
Well, one of the frustrating things is we seem to keep getting caught in this vicious circle of fighting the same battles over and over again. And I'm very happy to hear that these bills did not get out of committee. They're not going to be voted on this session. Hopefully they'll never be voted on. But I'm thinking about how do we turn our energy towards things that we want to see happen as opposed to things we want to not see happen. One of the things that comes to mind, just this morning I got an email about a bill that's being introduced in Congress to basically defund the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Program and devote that money to funding COVID vaccines. And I think Ed Markey, and I forget the other person who's sponsoring it, but it just gave me an example of things that we can be doing that would move us forward as opposed to just basically running around in circles. I'm wondering, do you know anything about that bill? Have you heard about that at all?
Yes, I have heard about that. It's an excellent concept and program. Yes, that basically the idea being that we need to, it's very clear that we have underinvested in public health and we've overinvested in militarism as a country. And so I think that's one of the very best ways that we can get engaged here is to contact our members of Congress, our U.S. senators, and let them know that we don't support more money for nuclear weapons or for nuclear power. You know, some of the champions on nuclear weapons are bafflingly supportive of nuclear power. Our very own Congressman Earl Blumenauer has been supportive of the NuScale project in the past. And so I think it's really important for us to speak up and make it clear where we stand on these issues so that we can begin to shift the narrative and not be playing whack-a-mole with all of these bad nuclear proposals. Again, you know, on average, the cost per kilowatt hour of the NuScale project that they are proposing would be over $50 per kilowatt hour. And that's far more expensive than the, you know, $40 per kilowatt hour or less of wind and battery backup array for the same amount of electricity. So we need to just be reminding our members of Congress that that not only is this the morally responsible direction to go in, it's also the better investment of our taxpayer dollars. And we need to not let the nuclear power industry continue to be the climate grifters of the energy world. And we need to move forward with what we already know. So I think, yeah, speaking up again to the decision makers, the power holders at the state and federal levels, even our local levels, is a really important way for us to be building a larger narrative of understanding and not having to continue to relearn and reteach these kinds of lessons, but to sow the seeds of a more long-term understanding that the age of the nuclear technology needs to be firmly in the past.
Well, Damon, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking with Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN, KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KABU staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KABU on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And now, during our spring pledge drive, you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we present an Earth Week special celebrating the Thin Green Line of Resistance with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute and Lemmy Tribal member Jay Julius. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with Atomic Power by Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Up to heaven to get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother.